On today's episode, I'm joined by Christian Nentwich, founder and now board member at JUCO. JUCO is a technology company specializing in data reconciliation solutions for the financial services industry. Christian is a technologist at heart, completing a PhD focused on software engineering and complex data validation. He's now also an active investor and mentor to the founder community. I look forward to speaking with Christian today. Thank you for joining us on the Innovators Exchange. And I'm delighted to have with me today Christian Nentwich, founder and board member of JUCO. Welcome to the show, Christian.
Glad to be here.
So, always like to start at the top of the show with just a brief intro to you individually and then the company that you're actively involved with.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm Christian. I'm, I guess what you would call a technologist at heart. You know, I was born and raised in Vienna, in Austria, for the first sort of 18 years of my life. Then had to do a little time out in the army, like we do over there, and then got on a plane to go to university in the UK and studied computer science at UCL in London. Went for sort of a PhD and then went on a journey of setting up a couple of tech businesses, right, that have actually turned out quite well. And so I'm still on that journey, and I'm a really passionate technologist. I think it's a magical thing, right, what you can do with technology without much by the way of resource, actually. And yeah, that's me.
Before we get into JUCO and where you are now, just probe a little bit that kind of life as a technologist. Quite a few listeners are at the early stage of their career or completing their studies, making those transitions. It'd be good just to kind of just probe a little bit more, like what kind of triggered the instinct or that ability to take what you were doing in academia, give you the confidence and visibility to develop products and solutions, right? Talk us a little bit more about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the magic thing about technology, right, and software in particular, is that you can go and do great things without really any capital at all, right? But, you know, all you really need is your brain, right? And you can solve problems that without technology would be impossible to solve. So, you know, as the human race in the last 50 years, we've created something that has never existed before, that has given us a lot of power. And so I grew up programming. You know, I am a self-taught programmer, right? I started this when I was sort of 10, 11 years old. And my first experience of this was sort of summer jobs when I was 15 and 16. And I was writing sort of credit card processing systems for people running internet companies and stuff like that, right? And so that first experience where you sort of see a problem and people have no idea how to solve it, but for you, you're thinking, actually, it's not actually that difficult if you do this, right? And sort of getting the look on people's face where they go, well, wow, how did you do that, right? You know, it's almost like it's magic, right? So I think that's a great thing. So it's obviously not for everybody, right? You know, that world of programming. But if you're leaning that way, I think it's a very rewarding. I think it's a very rewarding thing to be doing. You know, I did think on my journey, I thought I wanted to go down the research route, right? So I went to UCL. I was dead set on like doing a PhD on real time computer graphics because I was also like really into games, and met my professor Anthony Finkelstein, who luckily talked me out of this. He said, you know, this is all nice and sexy, but I've got some real world problems for you that you need to solve. So he convinced me to do a PhD more in the software engineering area on complex data validation. And so everything that happened after that, selling into financial services, sort of becoming somebody who's really at the deep end of understanding data, accidentally started from that conversation, right? I ended up not going into academia because I went through that cycle of publishing papers and speaking at conferences, and I really enjoyed that. But the rest of academia, I think, was a bit too slow for me. And, you know, it's obviously a very slow and methodical world, and I'm very impatient. It's one of my core attributes is I'm very impatient, so it wasn't for me.
Let me go back to what you said there earlier. I guess that trade-off between the sexy and exciting stuff and the real world problems, right? Because I think, you know, as an individual, you could get drawn into like computer game graphics for those who are interested in that space. That sounds really exciting, really compelling. we'll come on to it in a moment, but like some of the data management reconciliation type processes you guys have ended up being involved with would probably be, when I was starting out, the furthest thing if I could think about being exciting. You've definitely put some glamour into it since. But like, talk to me about that trade-off around leaning into real world problems versus what's kind of shiny and sparkly, and how you kind of trade off against that.
Yeah, I mean, I think real world problems have their own appeal, right? I mean, for me, and everybody is, I guess, motivated by different things, right? In their careers, you know, obviously for some people, you know, it's money, you know, for some people, it's some sense of how they're regarded in the eyes of others, right? When they're successful, right? For me, it was always problem solving, right? And where is a problem that is non-obvious, that is difficult, that is going to, you know, occupy, you know, that's really going to occupy my head for a long time, that that I can dedicate myself to. And the interesting problems are often sort of cross-disciplinary, they're hidden somewhere, right? They're in industries or in parts of industries where technology hasn't made much of a difference yet. And the secret very often is to be very good at something like computer science, but to also understand some business in great detail, right? So what I've ended up doing has only worked out well because I've also then understood financial services in great detail, right? I randomly ended up in financial services because my supervisor, one of my PhD supervisors, Wolfgang Emmerich, he was invited by ISDA to chair one of the working groups for the standardization of OTC derivatives at the time. This was in 2002, where, you know, everything was on paper, right? And ISDA wanted to create the first electronic standard. And they said, look, we have a real problem with validation of this data, right? There are many ways to represent an interest rate swap or a credit default swap, right? What's the correct way? And he said, I'm busy, but I've got this PhD student. And me, I didn't know anything about this. Nothing. No idea what an interest rate swap was or a credit default swap. So I said, I'll do it. And then ran and bought, you know, options, futures, and other derivatives, read the thing cover to cover very quickly, right? You know, what the hell is this stuff, right? How does it work? How is it priced? How is it?
Yeah.
And I ended up chairing the one of the working groups for FPML for ISDA for 3 years. And then suddenly, from not having anything to do in financial services, within 2 years, I'm giving strategic advice on data strategy to tier one banks, right?
So, I mean, that's fascinating, right? For me, that bridging the gap that you talk about from having that technologist mindset, the sector knowledge and understanding is the key. I remember chatting to start my own career, right, in the late 2000s, just in the run-up to the crisis and just after, people saying, well, you don't get much disruption, particularly in capital markets, because everybody who knows the space, and it's quite esoteric, is employed, like particularly by the banks, right? Mm-hmm. And then actually what happened is the throwing out of as mass layoffs post GFC, you ended up with lots of people who are now sat outside the industry who know how it works and can go out and kind of disrupt and innovate. And so hearing you bridge that knowledge gap helps bring to life how you plug that gap. So super helpful. So if I just move us on, you know, just more widely, why don't you talk about JUCO, how it came about from the ISDA seat, the journey. You've played a bunch of roles at the company and now founder and board member. I'd love to kind of, you know, hear your story there.
Yeah, so my first entrepreneurial journey was actually a company called SystemWire, which I co-founded. It was a university spin-out, right? So the university took a stake in it. You know, we took my PhD research and some other work and we set up a company. And I won't get into that journey, but we built that company, merged it with another company, sold it. It got sold to one of the big financial services tech firms in the end, right? So JUCO was then sort of version number two. And the sort of the starting point for JUCO was, look, I thought about things like, why is it so difficult to do things like dealing with different data formats and transforming data and working with it? I've seen all these processes where people, every time they want to do something to get one system to talk to another, they would have to write a Word document, and the Word document is then given to a technologist, and the technologist uses some ETL tool and they don't understand what the data is. They have to go back to the business, and there's sort of billions and billions of dollars spent on these projects. And I'd also seen some sort of other problems like this reconciliation problem that you've already mentioned, where, you know, a lot of trading is done electronically and then a lot of the stuff that happens afterwards is done on spreadsheets where sort of people sit around and they compare different versions of trades, right?
And just spell it out just for some of the listeners who are probably not living and breathing reconciliations, things like, just spell out kind of in layman's terms what's going on in a reconciliation process. Why is it so important? Why is it so complex from a data process?
Yeah. I mean, maybe in layman's terms, right? If I sort of, let's just take an example, right? Because so first of all, every business in the world reconciles something because every business in the world has a bank account where their bills get paid. And then they probably have an accounting system that records their accounting transactions, right? And so you have to make sure that your accounting system reflects what is going on in your bank account, right? Otherwise, there's a possibility for fraud or for losing money or so on. So everybody has to do that. Now, that's a relatively straightforward one because if you're a small business, your accounting package will just do that for you, right? But if you're a big business and you can't run your business on one system, you probably have 2,000 systems. You have a trading system, you have an accounting system, you know, you have these like reporting systems, you know, and your information is replicated everywhere, right? And if the version of the truth that's in the accounting system is not the same as in the, you know, the trading system or some of these middle office systems, if they sort of get out of sync, you know, especially in a bank or in a big asset manager, you could suddenly have a very big problem, right? You know, you can fail to detect insider trading, you can lose money because you're not valuing your trades correctly. So somebody has to compare this stuff or something has to compare this stuff. Now, for a lot of the sort of the processes that sit at the very bottom of a bank, right? Like, do we have the cash in the right account? There's been systems for that for a long time. But for everything sort of where people come up with new products, right, or they acquire another company. So let's say, oh, I've got a new financial product that I'm releasing, like a structured loan. There's no system that will handle that. And so what do you do? Well, you get some people to look at the systems every day and they log in and they put stuff in a spreadsheet and they compare it and they make sure that it's correct. And so we've got this sort of, you know, iceberg effect, right, where you see the top of it where, you know, people at front office is trading, blah, blah, blah. It's all automated. And then below that, there's hundreds of thousands of people still today, right, in the financial services industry, often in offshore locations, that then make sure everything is fine, right? And they sort of show up to work every day and they tick things, sometimes even with highlight pens, and they make sure everything is fine. Yeah, that's the problem, right?
Amazing. Amazing. And what particularly drew you, you know, because what drew you to that with Duca? What drew you to do things differently? Because sometimes we've got founders on here where things have, there's not a solution in place at all, right? And it's almost like a first order attempt at saying, hey, let's bridge that gap. But there were, I guess, rightly or wrongly in my head, I view you guys a little bit like a second generation. You were like a new, better version was coming along. Like what drew you to go in, look at that point and say, hey, it's already, you know, it could be done better or differently.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, if you see this, right, especially as a technologist, you go like, this can't be. I think the first reaction is you sort of go through the stages of grief here, right? So the first one is like denial, right? So like, this can't be right, right? Like, this is like, the firm I'm talking to is just an especially bad firm. This is like, I'm sure this is solved, right? And then you look around and you go, oh my God, this is actually, there are actually hundreds of thousands of people sitting around doing this. And the next thing is, well, it makes no sense to me because all it is it's actually a data integrity problem where data is stored in different formats in different places. So if we could just like overcome that problem that the data is stored in different formats and use machine learning, whatever it is, right, to bring it together and compare it, you wouldn't have to do any of this, right? And so I think our conclusion was people have just looked at this problem the wrong way, right? When you say reconciliation to somebody in the bank, they think about making sure cash is in the right bank account, right? When we think about it, we think data has been replicated in multiple areas. And how do we make sure the data remains consistent, right?
Yeah.
So we've just reframed the problem, right? Now, if you treat it as a data problem, you suddenly see that problem everywhere. And it's actually a much bigger problem, right, than making sure that the cash is in the right bank account, right? So you're right. It was an existing problem. We're not making a new thing that has never existed before. But here's the good thing, and from a business perspective, I think there's always money for this, right? Because a financial services institution has to reconcile, right? It can't stop. It has to either pay people to do it, or it can give us the money, but it can't stop, right? Because it gets shut down, right?
Yeah. Let's go there. I mean, just recap one thing you just talked about earlier. Your reframing of the problem about it being the data was interesting. I was on a panel last night around just broader regulatory technology and transaction reporting, and a guest said, you know, it's the data, stupid. It kind of, there's a recurring theme here about reorienting and looking at that. But you were going there next around, you know, the scale of some of the funding and the resources inside these financial institutions, how mission critical this is. The bit that fascinates me, particularly when I was growing up and younger in my career, I would look at the banks. There's a lot of technologists there, mm-hmm. very, very well paid and very capable. Why is it that this solution in your mind gets developed outside by a provider and the technologists in the bank themselves, you know, similarly, probably similar education profiles as yourself, you know, probably got similar kind of backgrounds in the technology knowledge. Why is there some of this stuff happens, the innovation, the relooking? Why does it pop up outside of the banks rather than inside?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, nowadays, obviously, there's extremely clever technologists in financial services, right? Now, the nature of the problem we're discussing here is that is such that every firm has the same problem, right? So it is a scale problem. It's not a proprietary problem that only one bank has, right? Nowadays, solving a second order problem like this, which is a sort of a middle and back office problem, there's not that many banks that have the amount of tech money to spend that they can afford to build this themselves, right? You know, most banks nowadays have to be careful to spend their tech budget on differentiating, value creating technology. If you look at the very top of the heap, then of course they've actually all built their own in-house solutions for this, right? There is a big difference, though, I think, between building in-house and being an innovator on the outside, which is if you're inside, you solve the problem that your operations team tells you about and you move on. And you don't have that long-term product mindset, right?
Mm. Mm.
A product company on the outside needs to be very good at understanding commonalities between all firms and saying no, 10 times more often than saying yes to feature requests, right? Because we cannot afford to build a proprietary system that only works for one firm. Now, if you build it yourself in that firm, that's what you do, because that's your problem set, right? Ours is to get economies of scale and sell this to thousands of firms potentially. So we need to simplify, find a common ground, right? And in my experience, technologists who work inside have less of a need for that product mindset and also don't have that product mindset, right?
No, that's a fascinating and very helpful distinction. And actually, when we observe some of those, what often distinguishes between some of the third-party vendors who do well and those who do less well is, I think, that discipline that you mentioned about this is my product and I'm not going to say yes to every request. I think sometimes we see some institutions that are customer first and trying to make sure they're doing everything they ask, and you end up with endless variants of the product. So I think the discipline you described is probably not an easy one to uphold in the short term, but it probably rewards you in the long term, I imagine.
It does. And, I think there are examples of this that sort of illustrate this, right? So attempts to take technology out of banks and then build product companies that sell across the market have generally not worked, right?
I've been involved in a few of those and none of them seem... Yeah, I agree with your characterization. Yeah. I'm going to move us on a little bit in the conversation. There's one of the favorite buzzwords out there at the moment, and not a hardcore technologist myself, but one of the ones that really is getting captured by a wider audience, this whole low-code, no-code movement. great to kind of like share your views on kind of like, mm-hmm. what is it? Why is it capturing the imagination? Why is it kind of something that people are seeing potentially as a bit of a holy grail to help fix a whole bunch of issues?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a really important subject to me, right? Because it was so important to the founding of this company, right? It's funny, right? Because everybody says low code, no code. And the fact that there's two words in there already tells you that something's already gone pretty wrong there, right? You know? So what's the point, right? The point is there are some things you can get people who are not technologists to do themselves. And I love that because especially in our area where it's all about data, there's a group of people who understand how the data in a business works. And it's usually the operational people, right? Mm. So they can pull any data set and say, I know what's going on here. I know where this is missing, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, our goal was how do we empower these people to sort of transform the data, validate it, reconcile it themselves, right? So they don't have to ask for help from anybody, right? But they're not technologists. And I think the idea is brilliant. You need to be quite sort of far ahead of the curve in terms of creating languages where people can express themselves without being technologists. So that means no esoteric syntax, but it also means people aren't used to reasoning in a structured, formal way, right? Generally, right? Unless they're trained mathematicians or computer scientists. So how can you let them express themselves, but without forcing them down that path where they need to be basically trained in sort of rigorous system thinking? It's really hard, right? You know, the Duke answer was, well, let's let them write fragments of English, right? And take that to a certain point. That means you can't do everything in Duke.
Yeah.
Because if you can do everything, now it's a programming language again, right? So what's the most meaningful subset we can give people so they can express themselves? And I think there are other companies that have succeeded in that. But then there's a really long tail of companies. This is the low-code part, right? So no-code is what it's supposed to be. The low-code part is where people then started sticking it on as a marketing label. And you've got these systems where you're doing stuff, and then suddenly there's a drop-down and a JavaScript window appears, and you're writing some horrible scripting language. And are you programming? Actually, I would say you are, right? And it's BS, right? So who's really done the work here, right, to figure out how simplified the problem has become, yeah. and what sort of person yeah. can now use yeah. this, right?
So hearing you talk, I think for me, it feels like the power behind it is more systematically bridging that gap so that you don't need to have a technologist to hand when you're solving some of those operational challenges, and probably more systematically making sure those people that are handling those data and operations can almost have the power of a technologist built in and embedded. Feels like that unlocks a big, big, big gain.
Yeah, I think that's right. But you also have to limit the power, right? Because you want to give them enough power to solve their problem. But because they're probably not a trained technologist, you don't want to give them so much power that they can start to, you know, build too much and build a spaghetti mess, and you know that nobody will understand, and then you have key person dependencies, and so you know, trying to thread that needle a little bit, right?
I just want to move you on a little bit, and you've had a fascinating journey, and I'd love to kind of hear from you about some of the transitions in your roles from, you know, budding academic researcher guided by your supervisor, spin out from university, then, you know, founding Duke, and then even the transitions within Duke, right? Changes in ownership, CEO to board. Like, yeah. you know, I think very privileged seat, right? A lot of you've gone very far and taken gone through many of those changes. I think people would love to hear your reflections on some of those key transitions. What changes as you go through those? What triggers those changes? What should people know about as you've learned along that way?
I think it's hard to overstate how difficult that journey of reinvention is, actually. It's not something I was aware of, right? So when I started, you know, with 10 people and sitting in a room writing code, I was one of them writing lots of code, right? And the first time I became aware of this, I think we got up to maybe in the early days, like 30, 35 people in Duco. And it was a sort of time where, you know, I had more and more of these discussions with my board members and investors going like, why are you spending time on this? You shouldn't be spending time on this, right? You should be doing that, right? And this sort of got more confrontational and heated. And 6 months later, I realized that I actually missed an inflection point here. Like, it's sort of like, I still remember this moment. It really hit me. It's like, crap, this isn't the same thing anymore, right? I have to really do things very differently now, right? And I sort of changed what I spend my time on. And, there was a lot of frustration that there's no explicit articulation of strategy. What's your strategy? What's your strategy? I'm like, what do you want strategy? I'm just trying to call people and sell them stuff, right? Because we have no money, right? So stop talking about strategy. We need to sell stuff, right?
Survival.
So, So I overlooked it. I did it 6 months too late. I think when it then happened again was when we're 100 people, right? And with 100 people and global offices at that point. So we were in New York, right? We had somebody in Luxembourg, we're already tinkering with Poland. Mm. So informal communication doesn't work anymore in that setting, right? Mm. You can't tap people on the shoulder if your people are across the globe. You have to formally communicate. You have to communicate 5 times more than you think you should be communicating. That time I didn't miss the transition because I'd become more aware that there are going to be these inflection points. And I also had, I would say, 2 really good mentors at that point, right? Who I talked to a lot, and I had developed more of willingness to change right? To sort of say, okay, maybe I'm wrong, right? Maybe I need to change now, right? Rapidly, right?
And was that a different group? So you talked earlier about some of the research advisors who'd guide you on the product side and problems to focus on. Was this a different kind of expertise and mentorship who are guiding you through this part of your journey?
Yeah, I mean, I've been very fortunate, right? I mean, I had as our first chairman and our first investor, we had Steve Gibson and Mark Beeson, who were sort of running a sort of VC and ICAP at the time. But then I had Chris Conde, who was the CEO of SunGard for a long period of time. He was a very active tech investor, and I'm fortunate also to have, say, Spencer Lake, who, has lots of banking experience and investment from Inside Partners in New York. And sort of this group of people they definitely knew how to run things at scale, right? But also, they just treated me very well as a person, and they were very supportive of me as a person, right? And so, and because they had been in operator seats, very respectful of the stress and contradictions and things you have to live with, right? So
let me probe on that. There's a bit of noise out there at the moment around this whole concept of founder mode people like. Talk to me how you navigate that balance between, that's a lot of expertise and advice that from various angles versus that single-mindedness to kind of, all the contrarian thinking. How do you kind of triage and kind of work out where to be responsive and where to take nudges versus where do you bloody man it, or where do you have to be just self-realization? How do you navigate that?
But I mean, if the fundamental question is when do you listen and when do you follow your heart and your gut, and your vision, right? That is hard, right? I think you have to sort of think hard about what are your strengths and weaknesses and be just brutally honest at all times, right? So, I'd started this company. I had never had a job, right? Think about that, right? So, and I'd never worked in a large business, which means I had no management training. And that has consequences, right? I mean, that means, when I started doing, I had no idea how to do a performance review. And like, why would anybody ever want a promotion? Who cares, right? We're all just here for the mission. So this is where I started, right? Yeah. And so I had to learn it inside Duco. And so I was much more inclined to listen to people when it came to company structure and, what is important to people and systems and so on.
Yeah.
And less inclined to listen when it came to how should we position in the market and what should the product be? Because actually, to be fair to them, they wouldn't have wanted to tell me that either, because they don't know, right?
Yeah,
you know, it's my job to figure out how where the company is supposed to be going, right? But now that I'm also an investor and an LP in a bunch of funds, and I talk to a lot of founders, that's so hard. Spotting the people who, like, the line between determination and stubbornness is very thin. And stubbornness will cap your journey very rapidly, right? So, I mean, you never get anywhere if you can't change and you're just stubborn rather than determined, right?
Yeah. That's some neat and helpful delineation, actually, your description of kind of the roles you take counsel on and where you want. That's helpful. Just closing this bit up, like any particular lessons that you've learned that you'd want to articulate and emphasize for the listeners here? Is there any singular point or any kind of takeaways that lived experience that you'd want to give back?
Yeah, I mean, I think that could be a very long conversation. Maybe a couple of things. So I've become, in my journeys, I've become very passionate about positioning, the importance of positioning your company correctly, which is, I guess, a classical product marketing thing, right? But who are you? What problem do you solve and for who? And almost nobody, I mean, there's a reason why not many companies succeed. Almost nobody gets that right at the outset, right? So every company, especially technically founded companies, they go through the same journey, right? It starts with the pitch is super technical, right? Like, yeah. I'll give you an example, right, Duco? Oh, you know, we're this new system with a brand new fuzzy matching algorithm that could eliminate the needs to bring different data together and blah, 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 right? And if you look at it now, and Duco talks about saving operations people 90% of the time that they spend on manual tasks, right? And you can see, you get this change between this completely inward focused, you know, here are these great, you know, features we have, to this is what we're going to do for you, right? And every day we're going to wake up thinking about how we can save you time, right, in operations. That journey is hard, right? And figuring out, and it's super, it always sounds great afterwards, right? Like, dope, Christian, yeah, you know, why didn't you just say that on day two, right? It's very hard to find the right positioning, and you only do it by talking to customers.
I think what you say is also particularly resonates, not just at the founding and the inception. You can have large scale companies that lose their way a little bit, right?
Yes.
Over that period. Yeah. And that, I guess when you describe it at the start of your journey, as I said earlier, it's like quite Darwinian. You have to figure it out or you just don't exist. I think with the larger scale companies, I think there is those same questions and realignment need to happen, but you don't have the same bluntness. You know, the weight and the scale protects them a little bit. But it's interesting hearing you.
It can and it can't. I mean, you know, there's. I think you're right. I think when people have to do product number two, or when the market they're in is stagnating and now they've got a real identity crisis, you know, who are we now? Then you have to go back to basics, right?
It's like that second album, being a musician. Yeah. I tell you, we see those businesses that we've got to have a bit more time, guys. We've kind of tapped out here. Let's try and write that second album. Look, as we bring things to a close, I'd like to move beyond work and would love to hear from you around what you do outside your professional sphere. What do you do to help enables you to achieve and do everything you've done in the day job? Any kind of hobbies or interests that kind of round out who Christian is?
Yeah, and first of all, I do believe that you have to keep yourself sort of in reasonable physical shape on entrepreneurial journeys that go on for a long time, right? It's exhausting. I did a lot of flying, right? So I think that's sort of the basis, right? So what else do I do, right? I play classical piano. I've always had one or two activities that make it impossible to think about work at the same time. So previously, I've done a lot of martial arts in my life. So that's great, because when somebody's punching you in the face, you're definitely not thinking about, you know, reconciliation problems, different type of reconciliation problem. piano. I started sailing recently. So 18 months ago. So I'm actually going tomorrow. I'm going to drive to the South Coast and and head out on the water. And yeah, so that's about it. But music's always been a thing for me, and I'm otherwise quite active. Yeah,
that framing is particularly powerful for me. That it means that you're mentally distracted from the day job and work. I think that's quite an important distinction. I found myself, you could be watching football or whatever these days, but you'd still be. It doesn't mentally preoccupy versus. I'm not a particularly good cook, but I'm following some kind of basic recipe. I just can't compute anything else. The mind is so fully engaged with following, Jamie's 20-minute meal that takes an hour that you it's fulfilling the obligation you said, right? You're distracted. You're engaged with something else. It's giving you the break.
Well, the only thing I would say is the only thing I wouldn't agree with is the word distracted, because I think all of us have too much of a habit of distracting ourselves, right? And so, and I'm not a fan of escapism, actually, right? How do I escape from the world? I'm sort of like, how do I become alert and aware and really dedicate myself to what's in front of me? And so music is good for me that way, right? Rather than a distraction.
That's a good distinction. That's a good distinction. Wrapping up, final question, which we ask all guests. So great to hear from you around. Is there an individual or a company that you'd want to throw the spotlight on that's doing something impressive, interesting right now that you'd want other listeners to be paying attention to or looking up?
I've been thinking about this, and I mean, maybe people want to hear about some company they've never heard of, but I'd throw the spotlight on Microsoft, right? I think it's easy to underestimate what an amazing job these guys have done in the last few years, right? Technology is brutal, right? You come and you go, and whatever you're doing is superseded by the next cycle, and you're dead, right? And I think building companies that last decades is very, very difficult. And if you think about the Microsoft from 15 years ago versus what Satya Nadella has done in the last years, right? The previous management wouldn't have bought GitHub, right? Everybody's coding with Copilot. They've got a stake in OpenAI. The core business is going well. The cloud business is going well. This is really, really difficult, right? To sort of maintain that relevance and be at the cutting edge. So I'm super impressed by Microsoft, right? I have a lot of respect for them.
It's interesting. It's interesting hearing your view, like in the news, but the understanding of what they've achieved is. It's interesting hear your framing. You're actually not the first guest who's thrown from the spotlight on them. So there must be amongst you technologists who understand it better. There's a deeper appreciation and understanding. Look, Christian, thank you so much for being so generous with your time, so generous with your thoughts, and sharing your experiences. It's been a delight to have you on the show. So thank you for coming on.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care.